want to tell you that we're also brought to you by Eglin's Best. In Arkansas, greatness starts early, before the pads go on, before the crowd roars. The day begins at the breakfast table. Eglin's Best delivers superior nutrition with more vitamin D and less saturated fat than ordinary eggs. You can start strong with Eglin's Best. Better taste, better nutrition, better eggs. For more information, eglinsbest.com. We'll take the headsets off here now that we're not going to talk to anybody else on the Zoom. Bubba, I mean, first off, when you look at what's happened since Arkansas lost to KU, it really underscores how just unpredictable college baseball is. I mean, who would have had this collection of teams in Omaha? And you've still got a couple of games that have to finish up today, Super Regionals that have to finish up. Alabama was leading St. John's last night in the seventh inning, 7-2. When that game got suspended, OU was beating KU 8-1 in the third inning. When that game got suspended, if those scores hold, then Alabama and Oklahoma will be the last two teams at the College World Series. If they make it, the SEC will have five teams there. But again, you know, you look at Omaha, and it's kind of setting up a little bit like it did last year, where you got a lot of power on one side of the bracket. Mm-hmm. The other side of the bracket looks like it could be navigable for a team, maybe Ole Miss. Maybe Ole Miss gets a break again, and you know, they end up at the championship series. But I mean, like, Troy is in the College World Series. Who saw that coming? You know, West Virginia. Everybody looked at the bracket when, you know, Memorial Day rolled around, and West Virginia, they were going to have to go through UCLA. Well, they never had to play them. And the team that won the Los Angeles Regional went to Morgantown and never really showed up for those games. It's just – it's so strange how, you know, we put so much stock on the College World Series and those eight teams, but it never feels like it's really the eight best teams in college baseball. So many breaks and luck and things like that have to play a factor in it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we say all the time it's not the best team, it's the team that plays the best, and you see it a lot this time of year. You look at a team like OU, you know, we saw them, and they had talent, but I would have never thought they'd be one still playing right now.
They lost four straight series at the end of the regular season and lost to LSU in Hoover. Didn't look good at all in that game down at the SEC tournament. And come home, you rest up, and they're ready to go.
I do want to give a shout-out to Chris Curry. Mm-hmm. And Evan Lee and the boys there in Little Rock. I thought I was proud of them. Ran up against a really hot Troy team, but boy, to get through that regional like they did, I thought that was impressive. So, shout out to them. That was fun to watch.
You look at how Arkansas did against some of these teams that are in Omaha. Obviously, they didn't have a good year against Georgia. They went 1-3 in those games against Georgia. Beat Texas in the only game that they played Texas. Won the series against Ole Miss. If these scores hold today, they swept Alabama on the road. They beat Oklahoma in a series here at Baum. So it's one of those years where you look at the Razorbacks and it's like 41-22. I've used the word substandard. That's what I think it was for Arkansas. It was a substandard season in a lot of ways, and we're going to dig in some stats and stuff here and explain that a little bit more. But you look at how they performed against these teams that have played, you know, the best at the end of the season. I think that, you know, maybe it makes that 41-22 record look a little bit better, even though, you know, there's obvious frustration with how the way the season ended up in Lawrence.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing, Matt, is – first of all, you talk about the teams that are still playing. And I think you look at – I think something – and even what Lance said about some grown men in junior college right now, I think when the roster's going to 34, you know, you've got some exemptions and all that. But I think there's more good players dispersed across the country,
no
I think,
doubt.
Right now than ever before, whether it be JUCO or some of your smaller schools. I think there's talent everywhere right now. But and I think that has something to do with some of the teams you see there. And I thought it was interesting that not a single team that was in Omaha last year made it out of a regional. And I think that's kind of telling because, you know, I know that we've talked about when you're in Omaha, it's hard to recruit. You got these guys going into the portal. That's why, don't even get me started on this whole, the portal shouldn't open while you're in Omaha.
Mm-hmm.
And the draft shouldn't be in July. There's so many things wrong about it.
Like softball, their season ended, I don't know when Oklahoma City ended, their portal opened today. Yet you got baseball.
Yeah.
That's, you know, the teams that are still playing, they've still got, some of them are going to still have 2 weeks to play. Mm-hmm. And they've already been portaling for a week.
Yeah.
Like, how does that make any sense?
It doesn't. And the draft in July doesn't make any sense. I mean, look, guys getting drafted, signing that we didn't think we're going to sign, and then you're scrambling to fill that spot. There's just so many things wrong with it. And I don't know who makes those decisions. I guess Major League Baseball, you know, and
it's wanted a
to move the draft back to coincide with the All-Star break. No one cares about the draft.
No.
It's not like you're sitting there watching the NBA draft or the NFL football draft. It's I don't know. I mean, do what's right. Move the draft back up to June and give coaches a break. Move the portal back a little bit. If they'd let me run it, I'd fix it. But anyway, back on our season. Look, 41 wins. Yeah, that's good. I mean, it's consistency. But I thought we won 7 out of 10 series. That's good.
Mm-hmm.
20 wins. We beat 20 SEC teams if you count the tournament.
Yeah.
That is good. But when you look at the team, I think people were frustrated. The thing about the team, and it was frustrating at times, we just couldn't stack games on top of each other. You know, you can look at some of the pitchers. They had a hard time stacking outings, good outings, on top of each other. Exception of, you know, Dietz and a couple of people. But, you know, defensively, we would have defensive, you know, let mm-hmm. breakdowns. Offensively, we'd have games. You know, you look at that game in Kansas, 3 hits.
Yeah.
You know, we lost 5-3 in that game. It was just the inconsistency. Mm-hmm. And, man, one thing about baseball is you got to be consistent. And I think that was the frustrating thing about this team. But I thought we had a ton of talent. It's a team that I was on board all year, even through some of the frustrations. I'm like, this team can make it. I was worried about a regional if we lost the game. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened.
Yeah, they had it set up the way they wanted mm-hmm. it, where you got Hunter Dietz going against the other team's number two guy.
Yeah.
You can't ask for more than that.
Nope.
And you can't ask, I don't think, for more than what Hunter Dietz gave him in that mm-hmm. game. I mean, he was awesome in that last outing. They just they didn't support him offensively. You know, we talked about the wins that they had over some of these teams in Omaha. The thing that stands out to me is the 22 losses and some of the losses that they had. Like game 3 at Missouri. We talked about it when it happened. Yeah. It's like that's one you're going to be talking about. Boy, you really wish you had that one back. Game 3 at South Carolina, the same thing. I would even go so far as to say game 3 against Auburn. You know, they beat Auburn in game 2. They've got, you know, the momentum to the extent you can have momentum. And I know the old Earl Weaver quote, it's, you know, momentum is the next day's starting pitcher. But I didn't think they played good in game 3 at Auburn. It didn't look real inspired that day. And then, you know, you kind of go through it. I mean, we talked about the 2 losses to Stetson and what that did to him from an RPI perspective. UT Arlington, you know, did the guy throw a complete game, or maybe he came within an out of a complete game? Caden Dygert against them on that Friday, where, you know, there were, you know, and I understand this happens in baseball. It just seems like there were more of those type games where it just didn't seem to go well for them this year. And I mean, you know, you even think about some of the game 3 slugfests they found themselves in. People forget they're up 6-1 on Georgia in game 3
mm-hmm.
here in Fayetteville with a chance to win that series. They end up giving 20. They give up 9 home runs and 26 runs in that game. Oklahoma, you know, another one where they've got a chance to sweep OU, and 7th inning just goes haywire on them. They end up losing that one 15-10. Just a lot of those type games this year where it feels like there were more of those type games that you look back, you know, the next morning and say, boy, that one really got away. Then I feel like you've seen from this program in the last 5 years or so.
I think so, and I think a lot of it, you look at the games that we lost, Matt, that you're talking about, those innings where the game got away from us, it was always an error, it seems like, that led to that, whether it be a ground ball, double play ball, should have been turned,
mm-hmm.
next guy, you know, we don't turn it, we either bumble it or, you know, we boot it or throw it away or whatever, or we just don't have a good exchange, whatever. We don't turn to next guy hits a home run. Mm-hmm. You know, it could have been an inning double play. It seemed like that when we made an error, it was at like the worst times.
Yeah.
And, you know, our fielding percentage, you look where it was, I don't know, it was
972 is what they ended up.
It's been a long time since I've seen one.
Well, I mean, from 21 to 25, they were 980 or better mm-hmm. every season. They were 983 last year. That was the second best in college baseball.
Yeah. And I think some of the errors that we made were like routine, mm-hmm. you know, and plays that you, you know, plays you got to make.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we made some great plays, you know, that a lot of teams don't make, but you got to make that routine play.
And some of the plays they didn't make are not considered errors. Like, for instance, think about the play with Mike Anew in one of the Kansas games where a ball bounces and goes past him. That should be a single.
Yeah.
It bounces past him and goes to the wall, and it's a triple. I thought that I understand he never touched the ball. But to me, it's like that's a mental error, even if it's not a fielding error. Felt like there were a lot of those type plays this year.
Yeah, I think so. And I think you even texted me on that.
I did.
Texted me to see what I thought. To me, that's a single and an error.
Mm-hmm.
I
guess it can't go down as an error because it never touched his glove.
Yeah, I get that. But if he's just kind of caught in between, do I dive or do I not dive? I've been there before. It's a tough place to be as an outfielder.
The ball on that turf was taking just crazy hops all weekend. And
yeah. So, I mean, but you got to – right there in that situation, just play it as a single. That's it. Just let it be a single. Keep the guy at first base. But it didn't happen. I remember specific plays that I screwed up, and I think you got to mess it up before you really learn mm-hmm. to get it right. And so, you know, I know Mike Anew probably learned a lesson from that and won't happen again. But you're right. There were a lot of plays that didn't get called errors that we should make. And I think we know that. And so, but it just seemed like every time that we made an error, the other team took advantage of it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what Razorback teams have done in the past. You give us an extra out. And we did a lot this year. Team gives us an extra mm-hmm. out. Boom. Next thing you know, we throw up a crooked number.
You know, talking about Mike Anew playing center field, there were so many guys playing, I think, out of position. And I understand. I thought Mike actually played an okay center field this year. But he's a shortstop at Marshall. And he transferred to the outfield last year on the Cape. Comes in here, and he plays in center field. We talked about how Carter Rutenbar is playing the corner outfield positions and first base. He's backup catcher. You got guys, Cam Kozel, he's not a shortstop. He doesn't have the range of a big-time shortstop. Like you watch a Justin LeBron or a Rock Chulowski, and you see a Vahevo Aloy, and you see the type of range that they have at shortstop. You can see what we're talking about. Cam, I thought, played pretty admirably at the position. And I thought he put himself in good position a lot of time, played a little bit back deeper in the hole. But, he's not a shortstop. He's not what a prototypical shortstop looks like. And he had that happening a lot this year where to get the best collection of bats in the lineup, they were having to play guys out of position at multiple positions on the field. Because I think it became pretty evident, you know, probably about midway through the season that pitching is not going to be as strong this year.
Right.
And so if you're going to win games, you're going to have to slug your way, you know, to a lot of those games, kind of like they did in game 3 at Kentucky, 16-12, kind of like they were going to have to do on the last day of the Lawrence Regional. And they did it against Northeastern, 110-9. But that just goes back to, I don't think that's necessarily what this team was built for. And so they kind of had to play out of character a little bit as the season went along.
Yeah, I think so. And look, like you said, I think Kozel did a great job at shortstop, you know, made almost every play hit to him. I want my guys to make the routine play. But, you know, back on the outfield, you know, I think of like multiple plays. Like I love Mike Anew, so I'm going to preface that, what I'm getting ready to say with I love him. But there were some simple little plays. Like there was one play where he fielded a ball, he goes to throw it, and it goes backwards mm-hmm. out of his hand. That happened a couple times this year. There was in Kansas, there was a ball hit the right field. Zach Stewart charges it. There's a catcher or DH running at first base. He comes charging it. That guy's not going to go first to third on you. You don't have to charge it like that. He charges it, it kicks off his glove, and everyone moves up. an extra base. It's just those little, those are mental errors for me. You know, it's an error, so it's a physical error, but it's a mental thing in the outfield. And, you know, you saw some of those. You know, you saw Pompey, and I love Pompey. Made some unbelievable plays, but then, like, a routine ball hit to him. He boots it. I think he just looked up too soon. He boots it and then throws it away down the right field line. Bases loaded, should have been a double play, inning. You know, those are the things that, that stand out to me. And it's part of it's mental, but I mean, part of it's physical, but a big part of it is mental to me.
And Pompey, I mean, that's another one that you could say maybe he was playing a little out of position. I know he can play third base, but he was more of a middle infielder when he played at Texas Tech. So you saw that a lot, you know, a lot with this team. And I think about defensive outfield, if Brenton Clark doesn't get hurt, if he doesn't tear up his shoulder in the fall, like I thought he looked really good defensively in left field in the fall. What kind of versatility does that give the team if he's manning left field? Maybe you put Damian Ruiz somewhere different on the field. Maybe, you know, it's just like we saw right field, it was kind of a revolving door this year, whether it be Rutenbar or Stewart or Cujillo Aloy early in the year. That didn't work out. You know, just with that 34-man roster limit, and I know nobody wants to make excuses, but it does, like it narrows the, like, it just gives you a smaller margin of error.
Yeah.
You know, and a smaller margin for injury, especially in your position players.
Yeah, you look at Cujillo. You know, the hamate injury in Hoover.
Yeah.
What if he's in the lineup in Kansas, the way that ball was carrying?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, oh, my goodness. I'd love to have seen him swinging the bat in Kansas. In that regional, just the way the ball was flying. You know, there's just, you know, it's hard because an injury can kill you right there. Yeah. And like you said, there was kind of a revolving door in right field trying to find the right mix, even at first base. And you know, Reese came on at the end and hit the ball well, Robinette. But he's
like
a guy you got to have. Yeah, you got to have him at first base. And I love hitting. Mm-hmm. And I love to see hitters go to work. And Rutenbar did a good job for the most part. He slumped off at the end. But I feel like you almost have to have a guy like Robinette at first base because he saves you so many runs, you know, than a guy that's, you know, 5'10", you know, with shorter arms. I mean, Reese 6'3", long arms. He saves you a lot of errors, a lot of balls getting by you.
We saw it, too, with Kozel. Like, he seemed to, like, really like to bounce the ball over first, and Robinette with, you know, that good glove and the long arms and the range that he had, that was a good combination for those two.
I think so, and I think it's just the confidence of the guys. And I'm not dogging Rutenbar. Rutenbar's going to be a great player, but I think the guys felt more confident with Reese over there, and they didn't think about, oh, this has to be a perfect throw. They could just throw it, and Reese would get it.
I mean, Rutenbar's not a prototypical first. He's not a first baseman.
No.
I'm trying to think, when they put him at first base, they were talking about, like, the last time he had played first base. I think it was, like, his junior year of high school. Like, he hadn't even worked out at the position until that week.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of telling to me that, you know, not only has he not played, he hadn't worked out there in almost 2 years.
Yeah, so it was one of his first games, and there were a couple close plays that both of them got reviewed, where he's stretching, but he's still on the middle of the bag.
Mm-hmm.
Like, one of them was a play where he was stretching out, but his foot was on the middle of the bag. Well, if you move to the edge of the bag, he's out because it was bang, bang. You know, and he had that much room. And then one was one on the outfield side where he was stretching, but his foot was still on the inside part of the bag where you got to slide. And I don't do this very often, but I don't remember who we were playing, but I texted Clay Goodwin and just get him off the middle of the bag, you know. But I know they were working on it, but people don't realize how much there is, how many things you can do at first base to save runs. What I see a ton are guys stepping too soon. They stride here, but the throw's over there, so they're reaching across. I saw Rutenbar do that a few times. You got to step to where the ball's going to be. There's just so many things, sliding from corner of the bag, this corner to that corner, getting on the middle of the bag and being as tall as you can so you don't have to jump and leave the bag. There's so many things, Matt, that you can do at first base that that you have to learn, and a lot of it takes a while.
Well, and there's just things you can't teach. You can't teach being 6'3" like Robin Ennis when you're 5'10". Like Rudenbar, sometimes he would be reaching out, and he's just extended as far as he can go, and that toe is on the bag by maybe like that much. Yeah. It looks like my 4-year-old trying to get up to a certain level in our pantry. I'm almost there. It's just you can't teach height, and he didn't have the height, but. I think you give him credit because he did get him. I thought he got better at first base, and he's one of those. I feel like he was the ultimate team player down the stretch because it's like, hey, you need me to catch the one game that Ryder Helfrich takes off. Here I am. You need me to be the DH. I can do that. You need me to be in left field today and right field tomorrow. I can do that. I can play first base for you. He was the ultimate team guy, and I think that's probably got to have earned him some points with his coaches and his teammates. This year.
Yeah, I like just his tough grittiness. You talk about playing for DVH, you take on his personality. Well, I think Rutenbar came in with that personality, that tough. I'll play wherever you want me, coach. Just put me out there. I'll get it done for you. And there's something to be said about that, and I love that about him.
So we mentioned fielding percentage being quite a bit lower. It was 11 points lower than it was a year ago, 983 versus 972 this year. ERA, 4.74 this year. You think about the last 2 years, this has been a team with a 3-something ERA. I actually was a little surprised, Bubba, to go back. I was like, well, when was the last time they had an ERA this low? I thought it might have been several years. I was surprised to find they had a 5-something ERA in 2023 with that SEC championship team. I didn't remember it being like that. So it's only been 3 years since they had an ERA of 4.74 or above. And then offensively, the number that stands out to me is 705 strikeouts. I calculated this a second ago. That's an average of 11.2 per game. You look back in the history of Razorback baseball. Before this year, 605 strikeouts, not 705, I'm sorry, 605 strikeouts, it's 11 point, what'd I say? I got to go back to my calculator here, 11.2 per game. Before this year, the record was 581 strikeouts in 66 games, so that's 24 less strikeouts in 3 more games in 2019, so it was an average of 8.8 per game. Well, that's a high number of strikeouts. T.J. Pompey, I think if he didn't lead the league, I think he might have been second in the league in strikeouts. There were just a lot of players who had high strikeout seasons, and that was something that really started to – it's one of those things that you notice during the season. It's like, man, they had 10 strikeouts. It really seemed like it came up toward the end. Like in Hoover, I think they might have had a 16-strikeout game and a 15-strikeout game. And you're facing some really good pitching staffs. Texas is really good. Auburn's really good. And you acknowledge that. But, boy, the strikeout numbers at the end of the season were really high. And it shows here in this in this record book, 605 strikeouts. That's the most in program history.
Yeah, that's a big number. So I hate strikeouts. I'm kind of a fan of the – I have a two-strike approach. I call it up, up, and up. You widen up a little bit, the choke up thing, you scoot up, you widen up, you scoot up, you choke up, and you put the ball in play. It's kind of like you saw LSU do it a couple of years ago with when they won a national championship with Dylan Cruz, Tommy White, those guys.
Tommy White was a great two-strike hitter.
Yeah, they just really take the stride out. So I'm a big fan of doing that. I know back when I played, when I got two strikes, I got wider. I was already close to the plate, so I really didn't have to get closer to the plate. But I was consciously, I wanted to protect away. If I was protecting away, I didn't want to get beat with that fastball away, and that keeps you on the ball. Then if you get an off-speed pitch, your barrel automatically runs into it, and you hit it pull side in the air. I don't know. Sometimes I was just frustrated that I felt like – and look, this isn't – I'm not knocking Nate or Bobby. I know what they work on, and they do all the right things. It's up to the players to go out and execute. And I think there were just times you didn't see us staying on that slider away or, it's just a lot of swing and miss at the top of the zone, stuff like that. Like I watched the 13-12 game, Georgia versus Mississippi State, and I don't know how many two-strike hits there were where they battled, they fouled off some pitches, and then they got a pitch over the plate. And I'm one of those that says, let's say you're facing a two-seam guy, and he paints a two-seam fastball down and away, take it. The job of that pitch is to get you out. If he throws another one out there, who cares? Take it. He's going to make a mistake. He's going to flip a slider up there and leave it over the middle, or something's going to happen. And you saw that in the Mississippi State-Georgia game where it was 13-12. They did a really good job of getting their pitch. And Wes Johnson comes on. He was frustrated. Mississippi State was up, so I think it was 7-0. And he's like, we're not on time with the fastball. Well, they went out that inning. I think they threw up a six spot on him, made it 7-6, 5 or 6. But right when he said that, it was home run to left by Jackson, home run to right, Lujo. I mean, it was just like, but they took the off-speed pitch and they were on time with the fastball. And it was, for me, that's hitting right there, is being on time, finding your pitch and being on time. Now, if it's off-speed, be on time. Pick a speed and be on that. But for me, if you're not on the fastball, you're not ready to hit.
I think the most frustrating thing for this team is that, or offensively for them, is that it felt like they were able to hit the elite pitchers. Mm-hmm. Like Aiden King, Liam Peterson, they were on those guys. Volchko from Georgia, they were on him. And you could go down the list. It was it's what I would call like the junk ballers. Mm-hmm. Think about it. There were two Division II guys. There was one from Missouri who came in and threw like 5 scoreless innings or something. Florida had a D2, like last year's D2 National Player of the Year. He had a pretty good season. But, he shuts them down. Dygert is a little bit different from UT Arlington. I felt like, there's a lot of off-speed stuff in his. I think Stetson had a guy who was kind of like that. Mason Cook from KU, I thought he was kind of like that. So, yeah. I don't know, it's just – and that was obviously one of their worst performances of the year where they had 3 hits. That was the lowest hit performance they had this year. It's just – it's strange to me. It seems like we see that a lot. And maybe this happens a lot of places where, like, the off-speed guys have a lot of success. But you think about, like, Dylan DeLucia in Omaha. Got it the same thing. Kevin Abel in Omaha got it the same thing. And maybe it's because some of these are, like biggest games of the season. I mean, Mason Cook, the winner's bracket 1-0 game, that's the biggest game of the season they're playing. And obviously, those games in Omaha were season-ending games. It feels like the off-speed guys in the postseason have given Arkansas so much trouble over the years.
The guy that we struggle with this year, it looked like to me, was your sinker slider guy. Mm. Little two-seam fastball down and then slider away. Maybe mixing a changeup with that. But I just felt like we played their game, not our game. Mm. And I'll go back and talk about Bill Robinson a lot. He was my hitting coach in the Yankee organization. Came over and transformed me as a hitter. I'd been in AAA for several years. Long story short, I would swing. AAA is a big sinker slider league. Change. Two-seam fastball away, I would swing at it. And he's like, well, why are you swinging at that pitch? And I'm like, because I know they're going to throw it. And he said, don't swing at it. The job of that pitch is to get you out. He said, hunt one up. They're going to make a mistake. And I was so worried about the pitcher's pitch, which was his number one pitch, the sinker, that when he would make a mistake, I wouldn't get to it because I was so worried about the two-seam fastball away or the sinker away. And it changed me as a hitter. And then all of a sudden, I started raking those guys because I quit swinging at their pitch. I started swinging at my pitch, and it made me the hunter instead of the prey. And it just kind of flipped the script a little bit. And I just seem like when we face those two-seam guys, we're trying so hard to hit their pitch. And look, once again, I'm not bashing anybody. I don't sit in on the hitters' meetings anymore, so I don't know what their plan was against the guy. But yeah, I would assume it was to hunt the ball up. Mm-hmm. But it's easier said than done. Yeah. You're dealing with college kids. But, I think those were the guys that we struggle with, or was the sinker guy. Yeah. We roll over fastballs and then chase sliders. And you're kind of, I call it being caught in between. Is he going to throw a two-seam? Is he going to throw a slider? And next thing you know, you're getting jammed on a two-seam and rolling over it, or you're pulling off the slider away. And so you're just kind of caught in between.
Fewer games than last year. Their power numbers ended up being comparable, not totally apples to apples. But think about last year; they had I think it was 100 and What was it, 118 doubles? They had 114 this year. They had 9 triples last year. They had 6 this year. They hit 127 home runs last year. They had 105 this year. And again, not as many games. So if they play the same number of games, you're really looking, I would think a lot more comparable numbers, especially with how, the ball just seems to be flying in the NCAA tournament this year. It's pretty amazing. Kind of hard to watch the games, to be honest with you, how high scoring they are. You'd mentioned Mississippi State, Georgia. Like, they were entertaining in that they were close. I didn't particularly like watching it because, 13 to 12, 11 to 9, like, that's just let's pitch a little bit here, guys. The power numbers, they were there again this year, and we weren't sure if that was going to be the case. That was kind of interesting. It's the first time ever that the Razorbacks had 4 players who had 15 or more home runs. They had 20 by Cam Kozel. They had 18 by Ryder Helfrich. And Zach Stewart and TJ Pompey both ended up with 15. It's kind of interesting. Pompey and Stewart, I think they ended up giving them the type of power numbers in the end that they were expecting from them. It just felt like it came in spurts.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think it was kind of a roller coaster. One day would be, and once again, I love Zach Stewart, but look at in SEC tournament. I can't remember how many strikeouts
he had. It was 9 in a row.
Was it 9?
He had homered 5 times in 4 games, and then he had 9 strikeouts in a row.
Yeah.
It just shows how fast it can turn on a player.
Now, the pitching was really good in SEC tournament, but that's a – that's tough. That can get mental on you if you let it. I don't know. Some guys they want to swing their way out of it. Some guys want to take their way out of it. I was always one of those. When I was struggling, the more pitches I saw, I started to feel better and better and better. Instead of just going up there and hacking, saying, I got to get out of this. I'm going to get the first pitch that's close. I did just the opposite. I zoned in more. And I was more fine-tuned, so I would hunt a pitch in a location. When I do my strike zone, it's 1 through 7. I would hunt 1 through 5, and I wouldn't swing at a 6 or a 7. And if I was going good, it was any pitch in that zone. If I was going bad, it was a specific pitch in that zone, a speed. Whatever speed I was on that at bat. Runners in scoring position, I flipped that. I gave up 1 and 2. I looked 3 through 7 and tried to stay in the big part of the field. That always got me going again, is sticking to that plan. And
when you say 1 through 7, can I interrupt?
Yeah.
Are you talking about it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 across? Mm-hmm. Because I see some people, like, they'll have a strike zone or a hitting zone, whatever you call it, that almost looks like a tic-tac-toe board where it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
Mine's across.
Okay.
Mine starts 1 is inside. If I'm a left-handed hitter, it's 1.
Okay.
For a right-handed hitter, I flip it and 1. I want 1 to always be inside.
Okay.
1 through 5. So if you're a righty facing a two-seam guy, you got to look 1 through 5, hunt the ball up and pull it. Mm. If not, you're going to get eaten up with that two-seam fastball all day. But the key is being able to take the slider. Or if you get in a slider count where you know the guy's going to throw a slider, give up the fastball, hunt the slider. For me, it's about hunting a speed. Then when you get 2 strikes, you just got to get in battle mode. Fight off the pitcher's pitch, and you will get a pitch to hit. It's just a matter of time.
It's fascinating. A reminder, our baseball podcast is sponsored by H&R Tire and Auto. They're a local shop. They've been family-owned for 3 generations. They built their reputation on taking care of customers the right way. That kind of longevity doesn't happen by accident at H&R Tire and Auto. All right, so we mentioned earlier the 3 players who have committed to Arkansas, at least publicly so far. There may be some silent commits in there, who knows. But they've lost 5 players to the transfer portal. None of the 5, I shouldn't say none of them played this year, because Landon Schaefer did play a little bit. Joey Lorenzini pitched a couple of times, and I think he was dealing with some sort of injury. None of these players, though, Caden Mitchell, Tyler Holland, Landon Schaefer, Joey Lorenzini, and I'm missing somebody, and it'll come to me here in just a second, another pitcher who is transferred out of the program. None of them, though, were real crucial to this year, and I think all of them, you look at them and you would have said Jacob Emoto was the other one, the junior college left-hander. All of them, it's hard to see where they had much of a playing time moving forward at Arkansas. So it feels like all of them are going somewhere else to get playing time. You look at, you know, who they're going to lose. I've got a list here of draft prospects. Ryder Helfrich is going to be gone. Hunter Dietz is going to be gone. They're both probably going to be first-round picks. Dietz might be a early second-rounder. Ryder Helfrich, Baseball America's got him ranked number 8 overall. That's amazing. He's going to be the highest-drafted catcher Arkansas's ever had by a long shot, too. Gabe Gackle, they got him ranked number 83, Baseball America does. Going down the list, Cam Kozel, you know, the expectation is he'll be gone. Carson Wiggins, we'll talk about that here in just a second. Colin Fisher, Ethan McElvain, I'm sure he's going to be gone. Kind of surprised, by the way, to see Fisher up so high in the Baseball America rankings. Tate McGuire, Damian Ruiz, those are the players who are ranked by Baseball America. There's about four or five players who are from either junior college or high school who are signed with Arkansas who are in BA's rankings. You know how this goes when it comes to the draft. It's all about, what's your number? And does the team feel like you're signable? With 20 rounds, they ain't wasting draft picks very much. No. So there is a vote coming up later this month by the NCAA cabinet. And this is going to determine whether or not there is 5 years of eligibility for players. And I feel like this is going to have a big impact on the draft. And, of course, you know, down the road, not in the not too distant future, you've got the new CBA for Major League Baseball that the expectation is the draft might even get shortened some more.
Right.
Maybe they change the rules. Maybe they can't draft high school players anymore, but maybe you don't have to stay in college for as many years. So this could really change a lot. But going back to the 5-5 vote, you think about some players like I don't want to single anybody out. So let's just say Ryder Helfrich, because we know Ryder Helfrich's not coming back. If Ryder Helfrich were to come back next year, all of a sudden, if that 5-5 vote changes or passes as it's expected to do, Ryder Helfrich, this is his bargaining year, but next year would become a bargaining year too for him. And so now you apply that to some of the players who, again, I don't want to use their names because I think people can use their imaginations and probably figure out some players we're talking about. But they could come back, have another bargaining year mm-hmm. with the draft next year. I think that this potentially changes things. And you talk about the calendar. This is the one time maybe in the history of college baseball that the calendar has actually worked, because you get this vote it's expected to get this vote before the draft, which is in early to mid-July. And so they're going to know by the time the draft rolls around, do I have another bargaining year or not? But this is a big deal, mm-hmm. I feel like, to the programs in the draft.
No, I talked to some scouts in Kansas during the regional, and they talked about that, how that could affect the guys they go after and the whether or not they think they can get them or not. They said it could have a big effect. Mm-hmm. And obviously, some guys are going to cost them more money this year because they have more bargaining power.
Mm-hmm.
I hope it gets done. I think it would be, the thing I like about it, you've got 5 years. You know, whether you play or not, you got 5 years. So it cuts out some of this stuff that goes on where you get these redshirt guys, you get your injuries, you get all this other stuff. I think it just clear cut you got 5 years. Mm-hmm. I think it's from the time you graduate or from the time you turn 19.
Mm-hmm.
I think is the way it's drawn up. But there's a few guys, and there are those guys that we're not real sure about. And I think we can say their name, can't
we? Go ahead.
I mean, in my mind, I think it's like a Damian Ruiz. Yep. I think a Nolan Souza.
Mm-hmm.
I think of guys like that are kind of like, maybe.
Maybe Cahillo Aloy.
Cahillo Aloy, absolutely. Those are the guys it's really going to affect. And I think it would be good for some of those guys to come back. I'd love to see Nolan Souza come back and play a full year completely healthy. I think he's a guy that could put up some really big numbers next year and really help his draft status.
About like a Tate McGuire. I mean, mm-hmm. He's a junior right now. But you think about if he came back, maybe see a bigger piece of the pitching set. Who knows? So I feel like, and again, this is going to make college baseball older again.
Yeah.
Like the game just keeps getting older and older and older. And I think this is going to contribute to that. So there's that little wrinkle. You look at players who we're pretty certain are going to come back next year. We mentioned earlier the Brenton Clark, the left fielder, who mm-hmm. people didn't get to see unless they were out at fall ball. I really like him. Yeah. I think that he's got a chance to be pretty good. And you talk like he had the red shirt year, and then he had the medical red shirt year, and you know that guy is just itching to get out there and prove himself. And sometimes those are the players who can be the most the most effective because they've had to sit and they've had to wait, and it's like, hey, it's my time to do this now. Christian Turner, he was a big piece toward the end. You got Carter Rutenbar on the mound, Cole Gibbler, Steele Eaves. So, I thought it was kind of telling that they put Mark Brissy and they put Peyton Lee out in that last game at KU. It was like, and you heard Dave Van Horn say after the game, he said that kind of is a good feeling for the future to see them pitch like they do or they did. So, the expectation is that they're part of the future plans. And I'm sure there's going to be other players, from this year's roster that are going to be back next year. But it is going to be a much bigger turnover than the 25 season to the 26 season. Because there's just not as many parts that are coming back. I mean, you could make a strong argument, Bubba, that they need to go into the portal and get somebody at just about every position on the field. Now, if some of these players come back, that changes things. But, you could make an argument they need a more experienced catcher. They're going to need another catcher regardless. They might need a new first baseman. They might need a new third baseman and a shortstop. You go all around, and it's going to be a busy portal, I feel like, for them.
Yeah, I think so. I think when you talk about catcher, I've heard rumors of a guy that's going to be coming that would be really good for us. I'm not going to say his name.
Yeah.
I think we need a Friday night guy, unless Carson Wiggins. And here's
Wiggins is an interesting – really interesting.
Here's the way I don't bother the coaches. Like, Matt Hobbs is awesome. I could call Matt Hobbs today and ask him a question about Wiggins. I don't want to bother them. Mm-hmm. They're in the middle. They're probably on the phone 24/7. The last thing they need me doing is going, hey, what's Carson Wiggins going to do? We'll find out. When they want us to know, they'll let us know. I don't want to dig around. I did call Nate Thompson the other day about a player that I liked. The Carson Wiggins thing is huge because I remember Dave at one of the it was at the Hunt Center. It was I don't know if it was for sponsors or whatever it was, but it was a get together
right
before
there. The season.
Yeah, and Dave said something about passing a hat for Carson Wiggins.
Yeah,
and I don't have a giant wallet, but I'd gladly put a few bucks in that hat.
Here's the Carson Wiggins dilemma. He could probably get drafted right now and command a seven-figure signing bonus. If he were to get drafted, it would probably be an indication that he's willing to sign, mm-hmm. and he's probably going to get over slot money. If he comes back and he pitches to the level of expectation that's there, I mean, this is a guy that's throwing 102 as a freshman, and Matt Hobbs told me in the preseason he thought that his fastball-off-speed combination might be the best 1-2 in the draft this year. Even without pitching this year, he said he thought that might be the best combination.
Don't say that out loud.
People know. you're talking about, are you talking about a top 10, 15 pick, kind of like maybe what happened with Hunter Dietz this year, maybe higher? I mean, you look at the slot values, number one pick next year might be $14 million signing bonus. Now, I don't know that he would be a 1-1, but could he be a 1-10? That's still a pretty significant amount of money. I mean, Hagen Smith was 1-5 and he got $8 million. So that's the dilemma for him is do you bet on yourself and say, I can do much better next year? Or do you take the safe route and say, I could get $1 million, $2 million, somewhere between $1 million and $2 million this year? I don't think you can fault the guy either way.
Yeah.
And I'm glad I'm not in his shoes and I'm glad I'm not the one advising him because that's got to be a very tough decision.
So – My theory on why he didn't pitch, my wife's a conspiracy theorist person. I'm not as much as her, but I feel like he didn't pitch because there's already a deal in place with somebody saying, we'll give you this much money. You talked about slot money. We'll give you this much above slot if you sign with us. Now, I could be totally wrong. This could just be his doctor being overly
cautious,
protective, and saying, I want you to go 15 months till you throw another pitch in games. It just feels like to me there's something already in place there. But I agree. If he came back, I was talking to someone last night, and I said he could be like a Paul Skeens type guy. Come in and go 1-1, get, what'd you say, the slot next year?
I think it's going to be about 13, 14 million.
Yeah. I mean, if a team gives you that much money, you're going to the big leagues.
Yeah.
You're going, and you're going there quick.
Yeah.
If they give you that much money. And look, another year.
They're paying you $13 million to stick around Colorado Springs.
Yeah, yeah. So I just feel like, man, if he stayed one more year, got a little bit more experience, because you're going to get developed more here than you are in the minor leagues.
Mm.
They're going to send him to A-ball somewhere, probably start him out in low A just to let him pitch some, get some innings. Stay here. I mean, be your Friday guy another year under Hobbs. I mean, he doesn't need a whole lot of fine-tuning, but I just feel like, man, but you're right. It's do you take the money now, or do you bet on yourself and you know, get 10 times that next year?
I think Dave Van Horn said something, pardon me, at the Swatters Club 2 or 3 months ago. He said, I think Carson's supposed to get married in the fall. And so I think he said maybe one of their recruiting pitches was, hey, come back and, you know, like be a quote-unquote kid for one more year. You know, enjoy that first year of marriage in a college environment, and then go pro. Again, I am glad I'm not the guy advising him, because it's you cannot fault the guy if he takes a deal now or tries to bet on himself and take a deal later. It is. I feel like it's a win-win situation for him. It's just for Arkansas. That's a big that to me feels like the biggest question of the offseason. Is what happens with Carson Wiggins. Does he come back or not? Because I feel like there's a lot of dominoes that can fall in a lot of different ways based on him coming back or not.
Yeah, I mean, it changes, because he's our Friday night guy if he comes back. So that changes what we're still going to go out and look for a Friday night guy.
Yeah.
It'd be nice to have two Friday night guys.
Yeah.
That'd be a good luxury to have. But, yeah, I don't know. I just feel like him coming back from Tommy John, I just think, man, one more year – of working out the kinks, getting everything, because it takes you a little bit coming back. I don't care how good you are. I know his bullpens have been really good. Just feel like it's always good to have a little more time. But it's easy for me to say. I'm sitting here in a chair. I don't have a guy dangling a bunch of money in front of me.
I pull out a dollar right here.
Yeah.
Well, Bubba, we could sit here and talk about this all day, but we got to wrap it up. Appreciate you being in here all season, and looking forward to doing this again next year.
Yeah, let's do it.
Hey, one more time, our baseball podcast this year has been brought to you by H&R Tire and Auto. They're proudly family-owned since 1976. They're trusted across northwest Arkansas, committed to keeping you safe on the road all season long. You can learn more or schedule service at hnrtireandauto.com. Again, you can find our podcast, search Whole Hog Sports on Apple Podcasts, Spotify. We put it on our Facebook, our Twitter pages, on our YouTube channel. Just search Whole Hog Sports anywhere. It's a weekly podcast through the summer. We'll go back to a daily format when football season rolls around in the fall. Hope to see you again next week. Have a great week.